This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, is the Trump administration to blame for the turmoil and lack of planning in Afghanistan, which led to the Taliban takeover in August 2021? That's what the Biden administration has asserted in a recently released after-action report. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. President Joe Biden and his administration are under fire from the Republican-controlled House of Representatives for the chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan. Michael McCaul, chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, who is leading a probe of the pullout, holds Biden responsible for, quote, the massive failures in planning and execution, close quote. However, the administration's summary, which is drawn from top secret State Department and Pentagon reviews, asserts that former President Trump failed to plan for the withdrawal to which he agreed with the Taliban. In fact, many analysts say that the Doha agreement, under which the United States agreed to withdraw all U.S. forces from Afghanistan by May 2021, was flawed from the start. The Afghan government was not a party to the talks, which sowed the seeds of mistrust and subsequent failure. The after-action report says that these conditions severely constrained President Biden's choices for how to execute an orderly withdrawal from Afghanistan. The summary also states that successive troop reductions ordered by Trump had left only 2,500 U.S. troops in Afghanistan when Biden assumed office in January 2021. During the last 2 weeks of August 2021, the U.S. and its coalition partners evacuated approximately 124,000 people from Kabul in what became the largest non-combatant airlift operation in U.S. military history. According to Reuters, the 12-page summary did place partial blame on flawed U.S. intelligence and military assessments that failed to foresee the speed of the Taliban takeover and predicted Afghan security forces would hold Kabul. Nonetheless, when pressed on whether Biden bore any responsibility for the disorderly situation at the Kabul airport in August 2021, Press Secretary John Kirby replied, quote, just by dint as the commander-in-chief, he assumed responsibility for orders he gives, close quote. For more on the blame game and the current state of play in Afghanistan, we turn to our veteran South Asian experts. Michael Kugelman is Deputy Director of the Asia Program and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center, a policy group based in Washington, and Elizabeth Threlkeld. She is a Senior Fellow and Director of the South Asia Program at the Stimson Center, a think tank also based in Washington. And both guests join me via Microsoft Teams. Welcome back to the program. Well, Michael Kugelman, let me begin with you. Is the Biden administration justified in placing most of the blame on the Trump administration for, in a sense, dealing them a bad hand on Afghanistan? Do you think they deserve the bulk of the blame, or is it a pretext perhaps for the Biden administration to avoid a certain amount of responsibility?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. It's certainly true that the Biden administration inherited a very difficult challenge in that the Trump administration had concluded an agreement with the Taliban that essentially called on all U.S. troops to be out of Afghanistan within just a few months after the Biden administration took over, knowing that the agreement also entailed the strong possibility of the Taliban on redeclaring war on U.S. troops if U.S. troops were to have remained in Afghanistan beyond the spring of 2021. So yeah, the Biden administration was in a very difficult position where it had to make some very difficult, complex decisions within a short amount of time. But I would also note that President Biden had, for a very long time, wanted to get out of Afghanistan as much as Trump did. You go back to the Obama administration when Biden was vice president, and he was really consistently the one senior official in the administration that had pushed back against President Obama's plans for staying the course in Afghanistan. Biden had opposed the troop surge that Obama called for when Biden was vice president. So I think it's important to keep that in mind as well. And indeed, I mean, there was a very brief, intense process soon after the Biden administration took office, a review to decide whether the administration should do. But my sense is that President Biden really wanted to get out. So it was, in a way, politically convenient to lay the blame on Trump and to say, oh, well, President Trump put us in a difficult spot. We had to think through very quickly what was going to happen. But my sense is that Biden wanted to get out as well. But when it comes to what happened during the last few weeks of the withdrawal, those last 2 weeks of August 2021, one has to put the blame on the Biden administration. And especially because, as we now know from that 12-page summary of the report, that the administration actually had thought through worst-case scenarios. Many analysts have thought that the Biden administration wasn't willing to assume the possibility of exactly what happened, of the Taliban taking over before the withdrawal was complete. So that, in my mind, makes the Biden administration's performance over those last 2 weeks even more blameworthy. I mean, it exacerbates the intelligence failure. Even though it was thinking about the possibility of worst case scenarios, it still botched the withdrawal over the last few weeks. So blame has to be laid on multiple doorsteps.
Elizabeth Threlkeld, should blame be laid at multiple doorsteps? Or do you think, as the Biden administration is trying to assert, it is mostly Trump's fault?
It's useful in the way that Michael did as well to step back and look at some of the structural challenges that were facing both the Trump administration and the Biden administration. After leaving office, Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad has acknowledged in interviews that part of the challenge in negotiating the Doha agreement was the or else component. So if you look at what the U.S. did and didn't require of the Taliban in that agreement, a lot of the criticism is that it was pretty weak in terms of the Taliban's commitments that the U.S. was willing to hold them to. And the flip side of that coin, as Ambassador Khalilzad pointed out, is the U.S. under the Trump administration wasn't willing to say, or else we'll stay longer. Those were not linked as conditions. And that is a weakness in the agreement itself, but it also speaks to the dynamics that Michael was raising, and that I think the Biden administration shares, of recognizing that more time with U.S. boots on the ground and NATO support wasn't going to fundamentally change the outcome that we were seeing in Afghanistan. So you really have to zoom out and look at that question of leverage and what the U.S. was willing in its assessment to put on the table in order to try to exert a little bit more leverage over the Taliban, which then could have, in theory, changed how things played out in August of 2021. The report reiterates the line that we've heard from the Biden administration, that there were no signs that more time, more funds, or more Americans at risk in Afghanistan would have yielded a fundamentally different trajectory. And I think that pretty much summarizes the position. Where the report makes an interesting and I think useful point that can be overlooked is in the broader damage that the Trump administration did to some of the core functions of the State Department and our refugee resettlement program that made this process more difficult than it would have otherwise been. The report says after 4 years of neglect and in some cases deliberate degradation, crucial systems, offices, and agency functions that would be necessary for safe and orderly departure were in disrepair. So they point to the special immigrant visa system, refugee resettlement, 12% drop in State Department staffing. So that doesn't absolve the Biden administration of the immediate planning challenges and response, but it does highlight some of the deeper structural issues that played into the challenging hand that the Biden administration was dealt.
That leads me to my next question. And to Michael's point, it is fairly universally acknowledged that the last 2 weeks of August were very difficult in 2021. And some say, as you said, Michael, that the Biden administration to some extent botched that. But as Elizabeth said, they were dealt a very difficult hand. And the fact that the Trump administration had actually gutted refugee support services and almost halted the processing of special immigration visas for thousands of Afghans seeking evacuation because, of course, they worked for the U.S. government. The Trump administration left a massive backlog that can't have helped the Biden administration, which doesn't, as Elizabeth said, absolve them for some of the missteps. But Michael, how would you characterize the situation today in terms of visas and getting people out? To what extent the delays still remain?
Well, here I could speak anecdotally. I personally know quite a number of Afghans who have not been able to get out, who wanted to get out and qualify to get out per the SIV regulations. You know, these are folks that had family members that worked with the U.S. military in Afghanistan. There's been plenty of news coverage in recent months how you've had private citizens, many of them from veterans groups, as well as activists and others who have tried to pull their resources together to help get Afghans who want to leave but have not been able to out of the country. So indeed, there are still many in Afghanistan that have not been able to leave. But yes, I think that Elizabeth is absolutely right in citing what I thought was one of the more notable parts of this report summary. That does indicate the policies the Trump administration had taken that, had they been left in place, would have made it more difficult to get more Afghans out through the SIV process. And that's absolutely critical. I think that the Biden administration does deserve credit for what it was able to do to get as many people out as it could, as quickly as it could. But, you know, there are indeed, and I can't point to numbers, but, you know, we're still talking about a sizable number of folks that have wanted to get out. It's all, I think, a very emotional thing as well, in the sense that those last 2 weeks were so traumatic for so many Afghans. We all remember the images of those that were desperately trying to leave. You had that terrible terrorist attack outside the airport gate that killed dozens. And I think sort of drawing on that and the emotional aspects of that, and then zooming out to the future, where people still remember exactly what happened nearly 2 years ago. And, you know, quite frankly, it's very difficult to know on many levels what's going on the ground in Afghanistan today, because there's not as much independent reportage as there had been, especially outside of Kabul. But it's very clear to me, as someone who is in touch with some of these Afghans that have wanted to get out, that they are facing threats from the Taliban, and their families could face threats to their lives. And I know that the administration is still trying to work on this issue, but much of the messaging that's heard, and certainly the messaging that comes through in the summary of this report, is that the administration did a great job not acknowledging that there are quite a few people that still want to leave. A lot of emphasis on how all the Americans that needed to get out got out. And of course, that deserves emphasis. This is the U.S. government. Priority number one is the safety and the well-being of U.S. citizens, but not much acknowledgement about how there continues to be a challenge with this issue of those Afghans that want to get out and should be able to get out.
Elizabeth Threlko, let me get you to weigh in with respect to the SIVs, that is the special immigration visas for Afghans. Where do things stand in your view? Is the Biden administration working quickly enough to make up for this terrible backlog that the Trump administration set in place? How do you see it today?
I agree with Michael, and I think it has been difficult to try to obtain numbers in terms of where things stand. Unsurprisingly, in an operation of this kind, when over the course of 2 weeks you end up evacuating over 100,000 people, that's an incredible number. And Michael, in his response, focused mostly on those who had wanted to but hadn't been able to get out, and in many legitimate cases, there's another set of Afghans who either were evacuated or were able to self-evacuate over land borders, for example, to Pakistan, who are in limbo in third countries waiting for further processing, which is taking a significant amount of time. And so when you think about kind of how this process works bureaucratically, it was an enormous lift and a lot of red tape was cut in those early days because of the desperation of the situation. And that was absolutely the right decision to make. Important to get as many people out as possible. And I think the administration should be commended for that. It's a remarkable feat. But process has to catch back up after that's happened. And so I think to an extent, as Michael noted, these efforts are ongoing. Colleagues in government are still working very, very hard to get the process moving. But there's a lot else going on in the world. And this is a crisis that has fallen out of the headlines to an extent. And so I think the challenge that we're seeing right now is maintaining the momentum and keeping that processing rhythm going for folks, not just who are in Afghanistan, but who are in third countries, kind of waiting for their next move, and in many cases, burning through limited savings and in uncertain circumstances all the while. So I think that's another component of this to keep an eye on.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you are listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Michael Kugelman, Deputy Director of the Asia Program and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center, a policy group here in Washington, and Elizabeth Threlkeld, from whom you just heard. She's a Senior Fellow and Director of the South Asia Program at the Stimson Center, a think tank also based in Washington. We are assessing the Biden administration's after-action report about the U.S. role in the fall of Afghanistan to the Taliban. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter at @Carol_Castiel or connect with us on Facebook at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Well, here's a shout out to Najib Hedran from Paktia province in Afghanistan. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, in our second half of the program, Michael, let's go quickly to what is going on the ground with the Taliban. I remember you famously said on a previous program that, you know, it's one thing to fight and win, but they're not very good at governing. I wonder if you would still agree with that statement today. And to what extent are they as isolated as ever? Does anybody recognize the Taliban? And we're dealing with, of course, barring women from secondary school. Now the UN, that is the Taliban leadership, are banning all female employees who work at the UN assistance mission in Afghanistan. What is your sense of the state of play with regard to politics?
No country has recognized the Taliban. That has not changed. And that's largely because of the social policies, particularly policies towards women that we all know about. And I think also to a great extent, especially in the case of countries bordering Afghanistan, concerns about terrorism and the Taliban's relationships with certain terror groups and an inability or a refusal to crack down on terror groups. So in that sense, they are isolated, though I would argue that they're nowhere near as isolated as they were in the late 90s, in the sense that you do have significant levels of engagement with the Taliban, including U.S. officials who meet with Taliban members in places like Qatar and elsewhere. So you do have these engagements, and there have been dozens of countries that have had senior officials engage with Taliban leaders on unofficial, non-formal levels. So I think it would be a mistake to say that the Taliban is the pariah that it was in the late 90s when there was much less engagement. Looking at today, you haven't seen many formal commercial accords negotiated, though notably there was a Chinese energy company that negotiated a deal with the Taliban just a few weeks ago. But that's really an anomaly. Bottom line is that the Taliban are engaging with the world, but the world is not willing to recognize the Taliban formally. In terms of governing, I would argue that I think they've actually exceeded some expectations on some levels, particularly in terms of economic governance. You know, this is a group that has been able, and I think we've discussed this in previous shows, the Taliban have been able to generate revenue. They have passed budgets. They've generated revenue from cross-border trade and customs tariffs and things like that. But one thing that's not clear, what are the Taliban doing with these revenues that are coming in? I think that's a big question. You know, a number of analysts have also pointed to less corruption happening with the Taliban in power. I think the World Bank, among others, have pointed to that. I would argue there that that may be a case not of the Taliban being non-corrupt, but more of a case of so much less money coming in from the outside world because so much international assistance has been suspended that there are not as many opportunities for corruption. But, you know, the Taliban, even now, I mean, almost 2 years after they took over, they do not face any threats to their power. The anti-Taliban resistance is extremely weak. It's based in the Panjshir region of Afghanistan. And many of the leaders of that resistance have actually had to take refuge in other countries. So they're in a good place, quite frankly. And yes, Islamic State Khorasan is a terror group that has been the rival of the Taliban and is trying to undercut the Taliban. They have targeted the Taliban in a number of attacks. The Taliban have tried to crack down on Islamic State Khorasan, the only major terror group that the Taliban are trying to crack down on. It hasn't stopped Islamic State Khorasan, but ISK is not the type of group that is in a position to threaten the power that the Taliban hold. I don't even think they're in a position to threaten to take over territory as the parent Islamic State had done in Iraq and Syria in previous years. So, yeah, they're in a good place, unfortunately, and their social policies are abysmal. They're terrible. We all know about that. But I think the Taliban know that there's no country anywhere, or no entity anywhere with the leverage to get the Taliban to stop doing those things. And we know about the known divisions within the Taliban. I think that there's some leaders in Kabul that are more practical and would like to see the group relent on some of these devastating policies against women in order to be in a position to get recognition and financial assistance from the world. But The senior leadership based in Kandahar, the ideological leadership, they have no interest in changing those social policies because that reflects the core ideology of the group. And they're hardliners. And in my view, they don't care about getting recognition or financial assistance as some of the more practical leaders in Kabul do. And I hesitate to use the term practical. When we talk about the leadership in Kabul, it includes people like leaders of the Haqqani Network, horrific terrorist organization. So bottom line is almost 2 years later, the Taliban are in a fairly good place in that they don't face any threats to their power. They've been able to do more economically than many think they have been able to, but they're really struggling, obviously, in a big way as well with a terrible humanitarian crisis and their inability to get international assistance makes things even more difficult. Islamic State Khorasan is a persistent threat. And that suggests to me that they're going to be in a very tough position. But for the foreseeable future, they're not going anywhere.
Well, that's an amazingly comprehensive overview, Michael Kugelman. So turning to you, Elizabeth Threlkell, to add to that or supplement in some way. And I just want to add that more than half of Afghanistan's estimated population of 38 million suffers from severe hunger, and 6 million of them are facing famine, according to the UN. So notwithstanding revenue generated by trade and customs tariffs, etc., that Michael said, there are major challenges. And of course, there's the status of women.
A couple of dynamics maybe looking forward to keep an eye on. As Michael noted, there are signs of internal dissension among the ranks of Taliban leadership. And this is something that analysts had anticipated. The adage, it's one thing to fight, it's another to govern. And that transition, I think, has gone more smoothly than many anticipated. But we are seeing signs, especially around these social issues, of some dissent and more open dissent than we've seen in the past. So the Taliban has, over the 20 years of the insurgency, been remarkably cohesive. That has been one of its greatest strengths, adherence to the orders of senior leadership and a sufficiently flexible structure that allowed the group to avoid the challenges with factionalization that many insurgent groups face. Now that they are in a governance role, I think it's worth watching how they navigate these growing pains as a government. I want to point to another colleague's excellent summary of this. Andrew Watkins at USIP just released an analysis of some of these internal dynamics within the Taliban. And one thing that he points to is what's known as either the moderate's dilemma or the propaganda trap. Because a question that's being asked right now is whether these very draconian moves, especially around girls and women's participation in public life and education, are limited to this closed off leadership based in Kandahar. And if there were to be a transition, perhaps the more quote unquote moderate Taliban based in Kabul would change some of those policies. And we could see over time, perhaps a generational shift, those that have been more exposed to the wider world coming to the fore and changing those dynamics. And the flip side of that argument is that part of the way that the Taliban have maintained internal cohesion over the last 20 years is through ideology and through a development of these very conservative social mores among their rank and file, that is what they have been fighting for. And if they start to pull back from that, there is a risk that those who have been with them in the trenches will start to ask, well, this looks fairly similar to the last government of Afghanistan that we were waging jihad against. What were we fighting for? And so to the extent that there are those domestic audience pressures within the group, that could be a more challenging dynamic to face rather than just attributing these social and human rights related concerns to the closed off perspectives of a small group in Kandahar. And so going forward, seeing how the Taliban navigates those challenges, those internal pressures, especially as you noted, Carol, in the context of continued economic, humanitarian challenges, pressures from neighbors over terror groups that are still using Afghan soil against other countries in contravention of their Doha agreements, most principally the activities of the TTP, the Pakistani Taliban in Pakistan, come to mind here. So they have their work cut out for them in the next few months, I would say, both in terms of internal group dynamics and their external relationships.
Elizabeth, I was waiting for you to mention the TPP. So thank you for that.
That's another challenge. Yes. No, absolutely.
That's another challenge for neighboring Pakistan. None too happy about the Taliban harboring them. But for now, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my terrific guests, Michael Kugelman, Deputy Director of the Asia Program at the Wilson Center, and Elizabeth Threlkeld, Senior Fellow and Director of the South Asia Program at the Stimson Center. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Please join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.